Welcome to KUOW's Record on Tuesday, the 16th of May. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. Join us on Twitter at KUOW. Today on our program, how would you vote when it comes to supervised drug use? King County wants to set up places where people can use illegal drugs with nurses and addiction specialists on hand. It might go to a vote this fall. So what are the pros and cons? You'll hear about that in about 10 minutes. First, though, in the news right now, President Trump is not denying he gave classified information to Russian officials. The information had to do with a possible terrorist plot using laptops to blow up jetliners. And the New York Times is just now reporting that that information came from Israel. Congressional Democrats and some Republicans call Trump's disclosure to the Russian officials deeply disturbing. But Trump said today he had the absolute right to tell Russia about it. And National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster says it wasn't even that big a secret.
All of you are very familiar with the threat from ISIS. All of you are very familiar with the territory it controls. If you were to say, hey, from where do you think a threat might come from territory that ISIS controls? You would probably be able to name a few cities, I would think. And so it was nothing that you would not know from open source reporting in terms of a source of concern.
How much of this controversy is about President Trump's decision making, and how much is about our actual national security? Here to help us understand is Jill Dougherty, visiting practitioner at the University of Washington Evans School and former CNN Moscow bureau chief. Jill, welcome to KUOW.
Hey, Bill. Very good to be with you.
What do you wish you knew about that meeting between President Trump and the Russian foreign minister and ambassador?
Well, I think I'd love to see a transcript. I would love to see precisely what they said, and more importantly, what the president said. Because right now, I mean, if you just turn on TV or you listen to anything, if you're on the web, it's a very, very fast-flowing story with a lot of allegations and denials and then more allegations. So what I would want to know is precisely what the president said and then kind of the context of that. The White House, in just the past few minutes apparently, has said that essentially what he was trying to do was pressure the Russians, that he was saying, look, you guys have to do more to help in the fight against ISIS. And then so he shared that information with the intent to push them to do more. Now, the others, let's say Washington Post and other media sources, are saying that essentially he let this information just kind of slip because he did not realize the significance of where that information had come from, or indeed the essence of that information. So you've got two things going on, I think, and you kind of raised it in your opening remarks. You have the, let's call it the more technical significance, security significance of what the president did or didn't do. And then you have the overall understanding of how he conducts himself, how he educates himself, and how he uses information, very important, secure information that really only a president has.
Yes. So let's for a moment set aside that argument about whether President Trump was being intentional or whether he was being prideful and let something slip. I want to know, how dangerous do you think it is or worrisome that the president shared this intelligence with Russia?
Well, I think there are two things. If he shared information that he should not have done with the Russians, Russian intelligence is very sophisticated, and they could find out by piecing together this and then tasking their own people to find out, where did that information come from? Now, why is that important? Well, it could be that the information, that the sources of that information might be in jeopardy, because after all, in Syria, Russia is coordinating with the Syrian government. Syrian government is fighting ISIS. There are a lot of connections. The U.S., of course, is too. But there are a lot of connections where those sources, the actual sources on the ground, might be in danger because information was leaked. Now, I'm just speaking again in broad terms. The other thing would be with allies. Yes, sure.
We found out, if you believe the New York Times, that the source, the national source of that intelligence is Israel. That's new information. How significant is that to you?
Well, that is correct. But I mean, that information eventually has to come from someone or perhaps just their intelligence services. But I'm talking about danger on the ground mm-hmm. to sources. The other issue is if you use or reveal information that is provided by an ally who, according to some sources, did not want that information revealed, then you jeopardize your relationship with that source. In other words, if Israel gave this information to the United States with the caveat that it should not be shared with anyone, then sharing it is a big problem. It's a big problem with our relationship with Israel, and it could be a big problem with other countries and other sources of information who would be very reluctant to share information that could be just spilled by some comment. Again, I'm speaking generally because we don't know really the specifics of this.
Okay, so this might jeopardize a relationship with an important ally, and there's a lot of fighting going on in the Middle East, as we all know, and maybe it reduces how much intelligence comes to the United States. What is Russia's foreign policy strategy toward the U.S.?
Well, you know, there are so many aspects that we could get into, but I'm just watching right now, real time, the Russian media and statements by the foreign ministry spokesperson, Maria Zakharova, and I've dealt with her over many years. Right now, she is essentially saying that there was a plot that Russia knew days ago, I believe she said May 11th, I warned you, she said, that the U.S. or the media would try to create some type of sensation about that meeting in which mm-hmm. the information was shared with the foreign minister, the Russian foreign minister, etc. Little technical interference. I hope you can hear me.
Yeah, let's see how it goes. I can hear you now. Keep going. Okay, so much for our connection there. We've been talking with someone who knows a lot about Russian foreign policy strategy about the United States. This is Jill Doherty from the University of Washington Evans School, a former CNN Moscow bureau chief, talking about what we know about President Trump's revealing classified information to Russian officials. And she says, well, that could jeopardize our cooperation with allies like Israel. The New York Times is reporting that information came from Israel. We'll continue to learn more about this. Jill told us she would love to see a transcript. I don't know about that, but we'll continue to learn about what happened in that meeting. And if you want to know more about what Vladimir Putin might be up to, his diplomatic poker game, so-called, that's the topic of Jill Doherty's talk tomorrow at Town Hall Seattle. She will be at Town Hall tomorrow evening at 7:30 at Town Hall Seattle. Still tickets available there to learn more about what's actually going on between the United States and Russia. This is The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. And coming up, would you like your body to become compost, laden wood chips, and left to decompose? The Urban Death Project might come to Seattle, and you'll hear about it in about 15 minutes. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Do you want King County to have the first supervised illegal drug use sites in the United States? County officials have already said they'd like to build two of those sites here. Now you may get a chance to vote on it. Signatures are being collected for an initiative that would ban King County from building sites where people could use illegal drugs under the supervision of a medical professional. So this could be on your November ballot. The chief sponsor of this initiative to ban the sites is Bothell City Council member Joshua Freed. Welcome, Joshua.
Thank you, Bill.
Why do you feel it's so important to stop these sites from being installed in King County?
Well, I think they're ultimately inconsistent with protecting the citizens of King County, as well as making sure that heroin addicts and other Substance One abusers are taken care of. So I think the perspective of Initiative 27 is making sure that we cannot open Schedule One injection sites or consumption sites, but rather make sure that we're focused on treatment to get the people who are addicted to these very harmful drugs into treatment. to make sure that their lives can be turned around going forward.
And as you know, Joshua, the proponents of these sites say it's not an either-or question, that this site would be very focused on treatment. There will be treatment professionals right there as these people are using drugs.
Well, they focused on the Canada model. So Vancouver, BC opened Insight in 2003. At that point, there were 190 deaths in BC from illicit drug use. In 2016, according to the BC Coroner Service, there were 931. So from 2003 to 2016, it's a 450% increase in illicit drug death. So clearly their model is not working. In 2015, 6,500 users went to the Insight location. Only two of them actually jumped up from there to their on-site location to go toward treatment. So it's not working. What I would rather see is we get people into full-time treatment to make sure that they get back to health. Surround them with a sphere of influence of people who are focused on getting them off of these harmful drugs. So ultimately, we can stop these deaths, improve their lives, and get them to health.
Also with us, Dr. David Sapienza, who specializes in addiction medicine and family care. Welcome, David.
Hey, thank you.
We'll make sure we get the proper microphone on so we can hear Dr. Sapienza. One more time.
Thank you.
Okay, I think we got you. So radio is a better place for ideas than it is for numbers. We can maybe send out some links to competing studies, but I take it we just heard Councilmember Joshua Fried basically saying that the Insight model, that's where what we know best in Vancouver, BC, he thinks it's not working. What's your evidence that it is, David?
There's Insight in Vancouver, but that's not the only supervisor.
Should we just switch microphones? Okay, doctor, let's try a different one. Yeah. We'll make you sound
is
great.
This better?
There you go. So much better. Okay, what's your case on behalf of these supervised drug use sites that could come to King County?
Right. My case is basically that, there's a lot of published evidence in the medical literature that these sites work to help people who are using drugs. They've been around in Europe since the 80s. There's over 90 of them in the world, so Insight in Vancouver is not the only one, though it's certainly the closest one to us. There's been over 75 peer-reviewed published research studies on supervised consumption spaces that show that people who use them actually increase their access to treatment overall. It doesn't show that there's increased drug use in the areas around them, and in fact have shown a lot of improvements in public order, less public drug use, less crimes in their surrounding area. And so there's a lot of published evidence over decades in the world that these sites actually work to help people.
Okay, so you're not going to agree on what the numbers tell us, but there is a criticism, as you know, David, that this is a step toward normalizing the use of illegal drugs. This is county sanctioned. What's your take?
My take on that is that, the task force recommendations, which I was not a part of the task force, were really a comprehensive set of interventions to provide services to people along the spectrum of drug use, people who are struggling with substance use disorder. Okay, and so expanding access to treatment is one of them. We absolutely need to do that. We agree.
You're agreed on that.
On demand is necessary. But we also know, there's a 2015 survey of drug users in Washington State of injection drug users that showed that about 24-25% of people are not ready for treatment right now. And the question is, what do we do for those folks? Because those people, even if they're not ready for treatment, they're going to continue using drugs, deserve evidence-based public health interventions to improve their health. Just like someone with diabetes who doesn't take their insulin regularly and maybe eats a lot of donuts deserves medical care when they have complications from that, people who have a substance use disorder and an addiction and struggling with drug use also deserve interventions that are going to improve their health, even if they keep using drugs. And we need to provide those services to those people.
Councilmember Fried, what do we do for or about people who aren't in treatment?
Well, if we as a community want to make sure that we're helping people.
Or maybe they are and they're still using drugs, but they're not as far along as you want.
Go on. We have to treat this at the individual level, deal with people individually, whatever stage in life that they're at, different drugs that they're on, whether it's heroin or other illicit type of drugs. So we do need to look at the individual and make sure that we're taking care of them. There was a comment made that actually the crime rate's gone down. That's not true in Vancouver. Of 3% of the population in Vancouver, 16% of the crime rate comes from that area within a five-block radius surrounding Insight. So clearly their program is not working. It's not helping people. Ultimately,
well, I think the county would say that they might put a site like this in a place, an area that also has drug use or other criminal activity, but it's really hard to compare how actions affect rates.
Yeah. Yes. Well, drug use is very clearly evident everywhere on the street. So obviously I went into Insight, looked into the facility, but as you walk in the five block radius around Insight, people are injecting heroin, they're smoking crack, there's drug deals very clearly going on everywhere. I spoke to a police officer and asked him, I said, I heard there's 5,000 drug abusers within the five-block radius. He says, oh, no, way more. So this is an epidemic, absolutely something that needs to be dealt with. And clearly, the BC model is not working. Actually, the last three health ministers of Canada completely disagreed with Insight and tried to do what they could to shut it down. But due to the courts, they could not do so. They couldn't reverse it. Yet all the numbers clearly show crime rates have gone up. Deaths are increased by 450%. We need to do something better, and that's really getting people into treatment. Currently, Insight is only having 2% of its users go toward treatment. They're not referring to the five other treatment centers within the area. Actually, those other treatment centers in the area receive $40 a month per patient that they see. They've not seen the funding from the state, from the BC government increased while Insight has been in operation. So rather than spend $3 million a year in Insight, let's spend some money on treatment and getting those people help.
You have said, Joshua, Councilmember Freed, that you want more treatment as well. So then what's your solution if that treatment money is not forthcoming?
Well, so there's $3 million that's spent on Insight in the BC model. So I haven't seen the numbers for here because I don't think they've released them to the public. But right now, Del Constantine and Ed Murray are talking about at least two sites. Now, two sites is not going to nearly adequately provide for illicit drug users in King County. 300 people really are serviced, regular users at Insight. They service 6,500 people per year. We need to make sure that we're having proper treatment. Insight would ultimately be located throughout the county here, or whatever the name they're going to call it. But majority of the overdoses actually take place out of the city of Seattle. About 75% take place in suburban neighborhoods.
Okay, so just quick, well, I want to hear more from the sure. doctor as well. So if the money you're calling for is not allocated, then you support these drug use sites?
I absolutely do not support the drug use sites. They are a failed model. I think rather spend the money on treatment,
okay,
making sure that we can give it to people, can sit with these folks and help them out.
Dr. Sapienza.
Yeah, the published evidence shows that he's wrong and they're not a failed intervention. Okay, we have over 90 of these sites in the world. There's tons of medical evidence that shows, you know, these sites have been endorsed by the King County Board of Health, by the UW School of Nursing, UW School of Public Health, King County, the Washington Academy of Family Physicians, the American Public Health Association, the Infectious Disease Society of America. Numerous people have looked into the evidence on this shows that they do work. So it's just wrong to say that they don't. There's published evidence that shows that they do work.
Doctor, I dabbled with illegal drug use as a youngster, mm-hmm, lightly. I think the social stigma against it probably kept me from using more. I'm not saying I'm like everyone, but would a county-approved site normalize drug use in some way? If not encourage, at least normalize drug use. Seeming acceptable.
Well, one thing we have to come to terms with is the fact that people in our community do use drugs, okay? And as a treatment professional, I spend pretty much every day in my office helping people who are using drugs decrease and stop their drug use. And I'm telling you, one of the primary barriers to having success on that is shame and stigma that people face when they try and reach out for help. I have people who come into my office that can hardly make eye contact and tell me that they're using heroin because they're so ashamed by the way that they're looked on by society. And if you can't talk about what you're doing, if you can't be open with what you're struggling with, then nothing's going to work. And we need to create a culture where people can be honest and open upfront when they're struggling with drug use, and stigma pushes people away from doing that.
Councilmember Freed, would you agree that shame and stigma stops people from getting the help they need?
I think shame is one of the most damaging things that we have within our society. And there's two different sides of this argument. There's an open arm acceptance of drug use, and on the other side, there's shame and guilt. What we need to do is making sure that we're looking at the individual and caring for them. I had the opportunity on this last Saturday to go walk the streets in front of Insight and all around Insight. I met with many people that are living on the street. I met with Dwayne. I met with Nordine. I met with Marcel. These are folks that their lives are hurting. They're broken. They're shooting up on the streets. They're living homeless on the streets. These people are absolutely hurting. Shame is not the answer. We definitely need to call out what is wrong, though, and make sure that they're turning from those difficult things, but we give them a place to turn to. It can't just be, hey, you're shame, you're dirty, you're terrible. It has to be, listen, what you're doing, your activity is hurting yourself. And the concern with having a state-sponsored or King County-sponsored injection site is it's like an endorsement of drug use. That's the concern of how people would read this, right?
Are you willing to accept that some of the, in your bigger picture solution, that treatment is the answer and not supervised use, that some people, some drug users, will die using in unsupervised situations instead of coming to a site like this?
Well, they are dying. And actually, according to the BC coroner, 90% of the deaths are occurring inside, 10% are outside. And what is Insight claims is they've turned around 452 overdoses in their Insight facility. So I actually asked a police officer whose job is to patrol those five blocks. Actually, there's 60 police officers that patrol those five blocks. I said, of those 452 overdoses, we don't know if it's one person 452 times or 452 individuals. I said, how many of those people are still alive today? He said, likely none.
Okay. I gave Bothell City Council member Joshua Freed the first voice here, and Dr. Sapienza, finally, your case for a yes vote on what could be a ballot initiative this fall. It would be a no vote to you because you're in favor of the sites. Go on.
I am in favor of the sites, and I want to make people clear that if they're signing for this ballot initiative, they're signing to ban in our county a well-researched public health intervention that's going to improve the health of people who use drugs and are struggling with addiction. So if you're signing up, you're signing up to ban that public health intervention. As a treatment professional, I want to be clear that there's nothing about these sites that is called endorsing or condoning drug use that's going to make it harder for me to do my job. In fact, it's going to make it a lot easier for me to connect with patients who are in active use and provide them the care that they need. These are going to improve our treatment outcomes if we open these sites in King County. I'm going to be able to do my job better with these sites in our community.
That's our time with Dr. Saar. We're over time. There's the clock that tells me so. Yeah. Dr. David Sapienza, who specializes in addiction medicine, and Bothell City Council member Joshua Freed. Again, this could be coming to your fall ballot in King County. Whether there ought to be supervised illegal drug sites in King County, the first in the United States. And thank you to both of you.
Bill, I appreciate you having me on. Just encourage anybody on this issue to actually visit Insight to inform their opinion.
Thanks to you both.
Thanks.
Thank you.
More of KUOW's The Record just ahead. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in today. Admit it, Christians, you have lost the culture wars. So says Christian writer Rod Dreher, whose new book is The Benedict Option, A Strategy for Christians in a Post-Christian Nation. You'll meet him in about 15 minutes. Bernie Sanders might endorse a candidate in the Seattle mayor's race. We can't confirm who that is, but Sanders' group, Our Revolution, tells KUOW that they're taking a look at Seattle. That kind of endorsement could be huge, with the incumbent, Ed Murray, dropping out, and more than a dozen candidates. Endorsements might matter more than ever. Here's reporter David Hyde with KUOW's politics team.
Groups that had previously backed Ed Murray for Seattle mayor are now looking for a new candidate.
We didn't think we needed to. We endorsed Ed Murray back in January for re-election, and so we're still figuring that out.
David Rolfe's head of the SEIU 775 and a heavy hitter here in Washington state politics. And Rolfe says even though the labor movement is in decline, labor's endorsement in this city still matters.
I think within the city of Seattle, probably 25% of the workforce belongs to a union. You know, Seattle's a very strong union town with a very strong working class history, and probably five out of the six last mayors got elected with substantial union support.
Before he dropped out, incumbent Mayor Ed Murray racked up endorsements from around 20 unions. But now many of those endorsements are up for grabs. Former King County Executive Ron Sims says, based on his time in Washington state politics,
endorsements are really important. Endorsements are an affirmation by other people that you're respected because you can keep your word and get the job done.
Sims' endorsement is sought after in this city. And he's at this event to endorse former U.S. Attorney Jenny Durkin for mayor. But Sims knows there are many more endorsements to come, including organized labor's.
To a lot of people, labor is a big stamp of approval.
So how does a candidate earn labor's endorsement? Sims says it's a combination of things. Can you get the job done? And what are your priorities?
People think labor, getting a labor endorsement is easy. Oh, no. Those, every labor union has its issues. Are you going to build? That was a big one. Are you going to be good on transportation issues? Are you going to respect the right for people to organize your labor force or continue to respect that?
In other words, especially for new candidates, the endorsements contest is a lot of work. And in many cases, the voters haven't even heard of the individuals or groups that are doing the endorsing. So why do candidates bother? Well, in the case of labor, even as its numbers decline, labor endorsements can help with fundraising. Labor helps turn out the vote. And as Margaret O'Meara, a history professor at the University of Washington who writes about American politics, puts it,
endorsements do matter, especially when the field is crowded and the name recognition of some of the candidates is low. When you have these third-party validators attesting to someone's qualifications for mayor, that can be a guide.
But O'Meara also says when there are a lot of candidates, the power of endorsements could get diluted.
Where endorsements will be interesting is whether you have all of the people and organizations that lined up behind Ed Murray all going en masse to another candidate, or if they get spread out across a number of candidates.
And the field this year is crowded. There are more than a dozen candidates in the Seattle mayor's race. Along with State Senator Bob Hasegawa and former U.S. Attorney Jenny Durkin, the list includes former Mayor Mike McGinn, community activist Nikita Oliver, urban planner Carrie Moon, and State Representative Jessen Farrell. And rumors are swirling around that other candidates may still jump in. The deadline to file is this Friday. For their part, members of SEIU 775 haven't decided yet who to endorse.
I think the labor movement feels that Ed Murray has been a really strong mayor for us and for working class Seattle. And I think, you know, in a lot of ways, we're looking for someone who will be equally strong.
David Rolfe says a decision on that now won't happen until June at the earliest. In Seattle, I'm David Hyde, KUOW News.
This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. I'd love to know what you think about our conversations. We're on Twitter at KUOW. For example, what do you want to do with your body after you die? Bury it? Cremate it? Donate it to science? Here's an idea. Why not compost your body? In the latest episode of KUOW's podcast, Terrestrial, Ashley Ahern looks into composting bodies as an alternative to burial. Ashley, welcome.
Hi, good to be here.
In this episode of Terrestrial, you profile an architect named Katrina Spade, who's working on an alternative to more standard burial methods. She calls them recomposition centers. How would this work?
So basically, Katrina's taken the idea of how would you compost multiple human bodies in one space in an urban setting. And she envisions taking an old building, like say an old church or, you know, piece of old real estate in Seattle, and having a core in the middle that would be lined with or filled with layers of pine or other chips, you know, of wood and other co-composting materials, and then layers of bodies in between. And the way, I mean, it sounds kind of icky, but the way Katrina's designed it is actually quite beautiful. If when you think about it, it would be a closed core, and then there would be walkways spiraling around it up to the top. So you would be able to carry your loved one with your family members, and then at the top, all you would see is a clean bed of pine chips. So I think it has a room for ceremony and ritual, as well as actual functionality and composting.
And your podcast, Terrestrial, is about the earth, is about the environment, and you say this could be better for the environment. How so?
Well, when you look at conventional Western burial, we know, according to some estimates, we put upwards of 8 Olympic-sized swimming pools of formaldehyde, you know, used in embalming fluid, underground every year in human bodies. And estimates point to about 1,800, the amount of wood that would go into making 1,800 single-family homes in the form of caskets that go underground. So there are very real questions about also how we use the green space that we have left. As more people live in cities, you look at, you know, cities passing, you know, well, moratorium, sorry, on new cemeteries, and no more cemeteries will be built in the city of Seattle. And so that means as a society, when we look at how we use the green space around our cities, is it for homes? Is it for food? Or is it going to be for dead bodies? And that raises, I think, some important questions as our population continues to boom.
Ashley Ahern, you went to a research facility at Western Carolina University to find out how this process could work, to go see for yourself. And what was that like?
I was nervous going into it. And I think when you listen to the full episode, you'll get a real feel for that, you know, we were watching an old man. He had died, you know, a couple weeks earlier at a local hospital, and he wanted his body donated to science. And he was being laid to rest in a pile of composting materials because the team needs to kind of test proof of concept, right? Like, what should we be using if we're going to be composting human bodies? How high do temperatures need to spike? I mean, this stuff needs to be studied to be designed, you know, to make a facility that will actually work. And so we were in the hills of North Carolina and watching as this old man was laid to rest in a field. And at first, I was really nervous about it. I hadn't been that close to a dead body before, and especially one in its natural state. I mean, he was still in the hospital gown that he died in. And they were putting him into this pile, and his body was already starting to break down. And that was, you know, it's funny. I was like listening back over the tape, and I'm asking all these questions, you know, very science-based. Like, so what are you doing here? And what are you doing here? And what's the question you're trying to answer? And it was all to cover up my nervousness around this central universal question of what happens to us after we die. And it's a natural process. And so I had this moment in recording this whole scene with Katrina and her team where I reached this kind of sudden calm and just kind of took some deep breaths and looked at what was happening. I was like, this is going to happen to me. This is going to happen to everyone I love. And it's natural and it's okay. And maybe we should be thinking about how we do this differently so that we can be closer to that natural process as opposed to spending all the thousands and thousands of dollars and resources into fighting that natural process, you know, preventing it and preserving ourselves the way we do, at least in the Western tradition.
So that's the effect that all this had on you at this research facility. What motivated you to go there to work on this topic of recomposting bodies?
So one side of my family I grew up is Catholic. And so as a kid, I went to open casket wakes. And the first one I was old enough to really remember that really stuck with me was my great aunt Gilda, and she died when I was 12. And I remember walking up to the edge of her casket, because that's what you did, you know, to pay your respects. And my little brother was standing next to me, and she was perfectly made up. She had this like rich blush on her cheeks. And I just remember my 12-year-old self looking at her and saying, she's going to open her eyes. Like, she could wake up any minute.
Yeah.
And 20 years later, I was kind of thinking about just the question of green burial and what we do with our dead. And I was thinking back to that moment and realizing just how, as a kid, I saw the truth of that artificialness and the kind of, it's hard to find the words, that we spend so much time and effort trying to hide a natural process. And it was only 20 years later that it struck me as to why that made me so uncomfortable as a kid, that here was somebody who was starting a natural process who I loved very much. And it was like we weren't accepting that that was happening by spending so much time and effort to cover it.
And of course, our attitude toward death and burial and bodies, that's a cultural thing. Mm. So how do other cultures think about this?
We had a lot of fun actually researching this in this episode. I found a professor, Amir Hussein, at Loyola Marymount University. He studies the world religions and death practices. And he told me this really interesting parable that we can play a little cut of tape here.
And there's this lovely story that Muslims tell about God sending an angel to the earth. And the earth, of course, being this autonomous sort of being, not wanting to give up anything of itself. And so the earth says, no, I don't want to give up any of my stuff to make something new.
So the angel goes back to God and he tells him, no dice, the earth is not sharing. So God sends another angel and then another one. Same response. Finally, God sends the angel of death to ask the earth for some clay to make people.
What that angel says to the earth is not, can I have this, but can I borrow this?
Can I borrow this? What did that say to you?
I just remember doing that interview and just smiling as he said that, because it just made sense to me. And so, you know, when you look at other world traditions, the Catholic side of my family, you know, or Catholics in general, Christians in general, tend to be a little bit more hesitant about this idea than, say, Muslim or Hindu traditions, which are much more about kind of shrouding and very minimal, you know, washing of the body and then a very uncomplicated burial process. And so we feature the idea of sky burials, which is Buddhist and happens in Nepal. And it's basically where they take the bodies out and they let vultures come and eat the dead. Yeah. And it's we play some sound from that in the episode. And it's pretty disturbing from the background that, you know, that I come from. But in thinking about it, you know, that's not so far from composting the dead when you think about it.
I wish we had more time, Ashley. Yeah. Did you decide whether to compost your own body?
I mean, I think I'd be into it. If one of these things is built, they're still fundraising and trying to make one of these centers. So hopefully it'll be up in the next, soon, for anybody who's interested.
Ashley Ahern, host of KUOW's podcast, Terrestrial. What's the line, decisions we make in a world?
exploring the choices we make in a
world we've changed. Terrestrial. And we're tweeting out a link to that full episode right now. Ashley, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Bill.
KUOW's The Record on Twitter, at KUOW. Last week, workers found a tunnel filled with radioactive waste caved in at the Hanford nuclear site in southeast Washington. State officials and tribes are calling for quick cleanup action. But wait, how did we get here? Correspondent Anna King has the history.
Michelle Gerber flips through a brick of documents and photos. She's a historian who wrote a 64-page report on the history of the Purex plant 24 years ago. Purex is short for the Plutonium Uranium Extraction Plant, and now its tunnels are infamous since the cave-in was discovered. The plant was built in 1953-55 and opened hot in January 1956.
And it was President Eisenhower's most important project. When he was elected, he called it Project X. And this project was literally number one in his priorities, was to increase nuclear weapons production for a program that he called massive retaliation.
Gerber says then, in the early Cold War, Eisenhower wanted to look strong to deter the Russians, so he built a plutonium-making war horse. The Purex plant is longer than three football fields. It stands 64 feet above the ground and goes another 40 feet below ground. Its job? Concentrate as much plutonium as possible from irradiated rods coming out of Hanford's reactors. It was efficient.
In 1 month, it could do what a World War II plant would take 26 months to do.
Water-filled rail cars brought the radioactive rods to the plant. The rods were lifted out by remote crane and then dissolved with acids. Plutonium traveled through the long plant in different baths of chemicals. It became more and more concentrated. Workers were shielded from dose by huge concrete walls. Don Woodrich was a mechanical engineer who supported work on Purex and other plants for about 40 years. He says using all those chemicals in the plant meant that
sometimes those pieces of equipment would fail. They might corrode through from the acids or something. And so then they would have to be remotely removed and disposed of so the new piece could be put in its place.
And that's where this train to nowhere was needed. That's the train tunnel that collapsed recently.
And for much of the equipment that was smaller, they could put it in a concrete box and put it on a flat car in a railroad tunnel and take it out to the burial grounds and bury it. But for some of the very large pieces of equipment that were very radioactive, they couldn't get a box big enough to hold the equipment and yet get that out of the tunnel.
The tunnel was made of creosoted railroad timbers and concrete.
It was always a concern of how long that would last. And I can recall people many, many years ago worried about that and wanting to say we need to go figure out how well that's doing and how long it might last.
Well, it's obviously a very poor construction method in our view, in our terms. We would never do anything like that. We know that radiation breaks down materials. It breaks down wood. It causes wood to decay and collapse.
But there are so many things to clean up at Hanford. Radioactive sludge in house-sized tanks underground. Radioactive cesium capsules bathed in a large pool. And hundreds of contaminated buildings. Five are giants, like the Purex plant. The train tunnel might have just been pretty low on the Hanford to-do list, or the nation's.
There's so many issues. There's medical coverage, entitlements, defense. It's really hard, I suppose, to think about these old DOE sites, but somebody has to fix them.
The tunnel is a reminder of all that's buried deep at Hanford. I'm Anna King in Richland.
On KUOW Seattle. Coming up today, you've heard politicians reacting to the reports that President Trump discussed classified information with Russian representatives. But what does the intelligence community say about all of this? That's coming up later this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for listening to KUOW Today. The number of Americans who believe in God, pray daily, and attend church regularly, that number is dropping. Rod Dreher is a Christian and senior editor at the American Conservative.
It worries me to see it fading away and fading away so quickly, not only because I'm a Christian, but because I wonder what's going to come after this.
Dreher's new book is called The Benedict Option, a strategy for Christians in a post-Christian nation. And he says that you ought to worry about America being post-Christian.
As Ross Douthat, the New York Times columnist, who is himself a believing Catholic, has said to progressives, if you don't like the religious right, just wait till you see the post-religious right. It's pretty scary.
Why? What's scary about the post-religious right?
Well, a lot of them are driven by race and issues of racial identity. And I think this is a tremendously dangerous thing for our country. I don't think many people would argue with that. But I myself have had some contact with some of these folks, and they have, in fact, Richard Spencer, the white nationalist who has been in the news so much this past year. I met him once in Dallas. He was home in Dallas visiting his family, and he called me. This was before anybody knew who he was. I just knew he was a conservative, and we got together for a drink. And I brought up Christianity, and he said that he hated Christianity. He was a Nietzschean, and I sat there and listened to him talk about his worldview very calmly, and it chilled me to the bone, frankly. Because here's a guy who was clearly very intelligent from an upper-middle-class family in Dallas, and he believed things that are so far outside the mainstream that I just couldn't believe it. And here he is now in the national news. This is what I think we have to look forward to for a lot of folks once Christianity fades away.
Do you make a connection between President Trump and the modern Republican Party and the decline of religion?
You know, yes and no. I think Trump, even though he was voted for by the overwhelming majority of evangelicals, I think Trump is a symptom of the decline of religion. I find it hard to imagine that a man like that could have been elected president in a time when we were a more faithful country. But I think it's certainly true that among religious conservatives, that's my tribe, that we have for a generation or more placed so much of our hope in the Republican Party and thought that the country was basically a moral country, a Christian country, and if we only got the so-called right people in office, if we elected more Republicans, got more conservative judges on the bench, everything was going to work out. Well, that never was true, and it's certainly not true now.
What are you recommending American Christian conservatives do about Donald Trump?
Thank you for asking that. This is a question that is on the minds of a lot of thoughtful Christians on both sides of the issue. I understand why a lot of my fellow conservative Christians voted for Donald Trump. Hillary Clinton had on many occasions signaled that she finds our sort of person deplorable, and she was a threat to our religious liberty. And a lot of Christians I know just despise Donald Trump, but they voted for him anyway with a very heavy heart. That said, I really am troubled by how uncritical so many Christians are of Donald Trump, of the things he does, of the things he says, of his complete lack of ethics. I think this is going to come back to bite us on the leg in the end, because we are being associated with Donald Trump, because some of the loudest Christian conservative voices, almost all on the evangelical side, not among Catholics, are supporting Donald Trump. And I think by placing so much emphasis on worldly politics, we ignored the culture, and we did not see what the culture was doing, the secularization of culture was doing, even to the church.
Do you find modern secular society more morally troublesome than America's history of enslaving and stealing from, fill in the blank, the savages, the dark people?
Right. Right. Well, look, you're talking to somebody who grew up in the Deep South and who lives back home in Louisiana now. And it's just disgusting to imagine what happened here within living memory in my own place, the way African Americans were treated. And to think about all the white Christians who did not stand up against that. I mean, that we can't erase that.
Well, more than
history,
not standing up against, the Bible was used as the rationale and the justification, wasn't it?
Sure. Sure, yeah, but you're right. But there was never any Christian utopia, and there never will be, or utopias don't exist at all anywhere. That said, The thing that worries me about where we're the time we're in now, even though it's so much better in many ways, is that we don't have a center anymore. And so how do we measure progress going forward? How do we know that we're progressing away from bad things and toward good things? When you look at what happened in Nazi Germany, you know, things that were supported by many church-going Christians back then, it is terrifying what is in the human heart to do. And I don't think we'll ever create a society that is not susceptible to doing that kind of evil. But nobody does evil thinking they're doing evil. They do it thinking that they're doing good. And what worries me is if we don't have any sort of agreed upon transcendent source of morality grounded in something beyond the here and now, that the sky's the limit. It doesn't seem that way to us right now, but just wait.
You're listening to Rod Dreher, whose latest book is The Benedict Option, A Strategy for Christians in a Post-Christian Nation. And your response to this secular techno-culture is to call for American Christians to separate themselves? You call it a modern monasticism? What is that life like?
Right. We're going to hold on to our faith and indeed our humanity, and what we know from the Christian scriptures defines a person. We're going to have to step back from the torrent of the cultural currents of secular modernity, not remove ourselves from it. I'm not saying let's go hide in the hills. I don't think that's desirable or even possible. But rather, we have to do like a lot of modern Orthodox Jews do, which is to say, if we're going to live in the world but do so as faithful Christians, we have got to strengthen our practices in the home and in community, in our houses of worship, in our institutions like schools, and get a much stronger sense of our identity as separate from the post-Christian world. In other words, if we are going to be for the world who Jesus Christ expects us to be, then we're going to have to step back from that world and be a lot more contemplative and self-disciplined in our spirituality.
And we have a lot of that now, right? That homeschooling and or private schools, and many Americans' life, sort of social lives, revolve around the church. And summer Christian youth camps, and we have these institutions. So what are you calling for that's any different?
We compartmentalize our lives. Church is what we do on Sunday, and as an add-on to the rest of the week. What I'm calling on us to do is to think more like the Benedictine monks who build their entire lives around prayer and the worship of God. What that means practically for ordinary lay Christians who live in the world is separating out away, for example, from media culture. I'll give you a concrete example. In my family, we have a television in the home. We have three kids, but the TV is connected to Netflix and Amazon streaming. My wife and I curate what our kids get to watch, and the TV is not on all the time. In fact, it's off most of the time. The reason we do this is because we don't want advertisers to seize our kids and to catechize our kids, and we don't want the mainstream Hollywood to catechize our kids. The thing I want to emphasize, though, is it's not like we're living in some Christian bubble like a lot of evangelicals. We're not evangelical. We're Eastern Orthodox. We don't live in this sort of world where the only music they listen to is contemporary Christian music. We actually expose our kids to things that are in the outside world. But my wife and I have control over this. So we, as I said, we curate what our kids are exposed to. I think that we live in a culture that caters to our every desire. It tells our consumer desires validate themselves, and if we want it, we should have it and we should get it. I think we have to make a conscious act of the will to stand back from that, to learn how to deny ourselves things for the sake of a greater good.
How does this highly religious approach to modern life compare to a Muslim life, which I hear Christians sometimes criticize, like they'll never fit into our culture, they pray five times a day, etc.?
Yeah, you know, I have to tell you, as a conservative Christian, whenever I see a Muslim woman in hijab or dressed that way, I actually feel a little sense of support for her, because she's believes so strongly in her faith that she's willing to risk the scorn of others to identify as a Muslim. That said, I think that, you know, a lot of progressives who see Christians as the great threat to the public order by the things we desire and by how different we are, they ought to ask themselves, do they see Muslims in the same way, or devout Hindus? Because it's easy for a lot of progressives to feel sympathy for religious minorities who aren't Christian and to have this double standard, in the same way that a lot of conservative Christians have a double standard too, want progressives to give us room to be ourselves, but we're not willing to do that for Muslims.
Finally, Rod, we started out talking about the decline of religion in America. I'm in Seattle, where religious affiliation is especially low. What's your message to non-Christians listening?
I would ask my progressive friends not to assume that the worst spokesman for Christianity, the most political or crass or ugly people in the public square, represent all Christians. Christians have a lot to give to this country. They've given a lot to this country, and we have a lot to give. But we just ask for the same kind of tolerance and liberty in our personal lives that progressives have asked for a long time. I think that we're in a very dangerous time in this country when we're coming apart at the seams politically, culturally, religiously. And I think that if we're going to try to hold this thing together and get to a better place and get through these challenges we're facing now, we've got to learn to love each other and to be more tolerant of each other. And that includes tolerating the right of our neighbors to be wrong.
You want to hold things together, Rod. Yet your book is, you're advocating keep staying more culturally separate.
Well, no, I think that, you know, in American history, one of the great advantages of living in America is that we have had room to be different. I want to keep that going because this is my country too, and I want my kids to grow up in a country where people are living in relative peace with each other and prosperity. I doubt that's going to happen, but we have to keep trying. We have to have hope that people will listen to the better angels of their nature, but we also have to prepare for that if the day should come when they don't do that anymore. The genius of Martin Luther King, the moral genius of that man, was he believed in love and not returning hatred for hatred. I think this is going to be a tremendous challenge for all of us Christians going forward.
Rod Dreher is senior editor at The American Conservative, and his new book is The Benedict Option, A Strategy for Christians in a Post-Christian Nation. Okay, so that's the decline of Christianity. Coming up later today, the decline of milk. Americans are drinking less and less cow's milk. We'll find out why and whether that might change and whether it ought to change on KOW's All Things Considered. Thanks for tuning in. Get our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get them. Let us know what you have to say about the conversations you heard today. Our email address is record@kuow.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in today. Back tomorrow.